This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And if that doesn't make you smile, you are a cold-hearted soul. No matter how many times I hear that baby, it still gives me the giggles. Humans are actually kind of hardwired to melt at the sound of a baby laughing. And it turns out we're hardwired to laugh, too. But until recently, not much was known about how humor develops in infants or what it says about babies' understanding of the world around them, of themselves, and of the inner lives of the adults that care for them. One Vermont researcher has been filling in the blanks, and her work is being recognized far and wide. Gina Miro is a professor of psychology at Johnson State College, and she joins us today to talk about how our sense of humor develops. Welcome, Professor Miro.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So, do you still get a kick out of hearing a baby laugh, or do you have that, you know, sort of cold researcher's demeanor where this is purely research, not fun?
No, it still makes me melt as well. And in fact, when my undergrads are in my office, which doubles as a lab, and they're coding the behavior of the babies that we study, we oftentimes have to pause the video and just say, aw. Or sometimes they'll beckon me closer and say, you have to see this baby. This baby is so cute. So we take a moment to do that. And then we put our objective hats back on.
You should do a study on what it does to the well-being, health and well-being of your students to be working on baby laughter all the time. I bet it does something.
I think so. And I do want to actually acknowledge, I have some amazing undergraduates who work on this project who really are the cog in the wheel, so to speak, Cassandra Cousineau and Brady Rainville right now, who are just incredible researchers and have great minds and contribute so much. So as well as being lots of fun to work with.
When do babies actually start laughing?
Well, it varies a little bit, but generally speaking, around 3.5 or 4 months. And that is a universal developmental milestone. So it doesn't matter where the baby is growing up, where they live, what their language is. That's universal. It happens across cultures for typically developing babies.
And are they just laughing in response to some funny face their caregiver is making?
Well, it's a good question. You know, there have been a couple of studies that have looked at what makes a baby laugh. You know, what is there a universal joke for babies? People always ask me, how do I get a baby to laugh? And it turns out that there really is no universal joke. So it seems that some of the research has suggested that for young babies, 3.5 to about 5 months, that auditory and tactile stimuli are more important to eliciting laughter. But that for infants over the age of 6 months, then visual and social events are funnier. But really, when you look at any of those events, they're social. So ultimately, what it takes to make a baby laugh is another person, even more than a joke.
So at what point does a baby laugh even if the other person that's with them is not laughing or does not find it funny that the baby threw the food on the floor?
Right. Well, you know, this is something that we sort of accidentally discovered in our research. We really expected that young babies around 6 months of age would not find an event funny unless somebody was indicating to them that it was funny. Somebody else was laughing. So we set up these little experimental manipulations to essentially control the messages that parents were giving to infants during absurd events. And what just knocked our socks off is that these young babies found the events funny anyway, even when parents didn't give them those cues. So we subsequently dialed it back. We just completed a study with 5-month-olds and have found that 5-month-olds will do the same thing as 6-month-olds. They seem to, crack up at absurd events, even when mom or dad are not giving them those kinds of cues. We just didn't expect this. This is what I love about science, that, it's really exciting when what you expect is confirmed, but it's really, in some ways, more interesting when what you expect is not confirmed because it sends you right back to the drawing board. So,
but 5 months, I mean, that's not
crazy.
Long after a baby has learned to laugh at anything.
No, it's really just about 4 to 6 weeks of laughing experience. So the reason that this is so intriguing to developmental psychologists is because humor and laughter really tell us something about what infants are paying attention to. So initially, our initial thought was, well, they're paying attention to the affect or the emotions of others. And it turns out that certainly the affect and emotions of others are important. But when it comes to perceiving or pulling out the absurdity, detecting that incongruity in the environment, they're doing it all on their own. The tricky piece now is to figure out, you know, why is it that they're laughing instead of showing some other response? Why aren't they just looking surprised or interested, or, you know, how is it that they know that this is amusing? So we're still sort of cracking the code on that, but we have some good guesses we're going to follow up with.
What are your guesses? Are you all ready to share any of them?
Sure, yeah. Well, one is that it's simply a response to the social. So again, these events that we present them with, they occur in a social setting. It's another person who's We say we're putting on little comedy clubs for babies. So there's another person performing this event, and mom or dad is present there as well. So that just provides a social context, and it could be that that in and of itself is enough to cause the baby to laugh. And in fact, this might be their attempt to engage their social partners in laughing. Even with 4 weeks of laughing experience, they probably are pretty savvy to know that that's a powerful way to elicit somebody else's involvement or interaction. So that's one guess. The other guess is that, you know, there's been all kinds of research looking at what infants know about the physical world. So starting at about 3.5 to 4 months of age, infants are really surprised by violations of physics. So for example, if an object just disappears into thin air, or if you let go of an object and it doesn't drop to the ground, something that defies gravity, infants will stare at that with real puzzlement, as though this is not what they were expecting. But interestingly, they don't laugh at those events. So they recognize them, they pay attention to them, but they don't find them amusing. So one hypothesis that we're going to check out at this point, next in line, so to speak, is the idea that infants might have some expectations for social behavior as well, not just events involving physics. So so that's our second best guess.
And are you sure that when babies are laughing at that young age, they're laughing because they find something funny? I mean, you mentioned that often it may be to elicit a response from a caregiver, so maybe they just know that that auditory signal gets their caregiver to smile back.
Yeah, you know, this is a great question. And it is a little bit of a debate within developmental psychology about whether or not infants' facial expressions really give away their internal emotional experience. And there's two camps there. One camp says, well, we really can't know. And the other camp says, what are you kidding? I mean, of course, they're expressing joy. So I think that there's, you know, most reasonable psychologists would come down in the second camp and say this is clearly joy. I mean, you know, it's important to be skeptical scientists, but there's also physiological corroborating evidence that what we're seeing isn't just skin deep, that, you know, what we see in their faces, in fact, is matched by a physiological response. And, you know, not to get too far ahead, but we've just collected some really exciting data on 4-month-olds in our study, where we show them these same silly events, and they are not smiling more at them, but they are showing the physiological response we would expect. So it's as though they're distinguishing these events, the ordinary from the absurd events. It's showing up in their heart rate, even though it's not showing up on their faces.
Huh.
So this is super exciting. We just found this last week. And it's still, you know, I have to say, to be a conservative scientist, we have to wait for the scrutiny of our scientific peers for some alternative explanations. But meanwhile, it's just really exciting.
But you do have evidence, too, that babies, what is it, as young as 6 months can fake laugh, and
yes,
you can determine that they are laughing in a fake way, not necessarily that sort of pure joy.
Yes, yes. So my colleague Vasu Reddy found this in, she works in the UK, she found this in 8-month-old babies. And when I first started investigating humor in infants, I was looking for the precursors to what she found, so looking at younger babies. And she had found that parents would just anecdotally report that their infants would fake laugh. So we went about it a little more systematically to find out. And we found that parents in our first sample, when their infants reached 6 months, The vast majority of them had already observed fake laughter at that age. So this is, it comes in a variety of forms. One is what would be called polite laughter. This is when the baby sort of wants to keep the game of peekaboo going, but maybe it's not that interesting anymore. So they kind of give a little, you know, it's try a little harder, mom or dad. And fake laughter, or the other kind of laughter is when an infant maybe is left out of a humorous interaction. Maybe sibling and mom or sibling and dad are enjoying something and the baby is left out. So they do a fake laugh. It might almost sound like a cough, but it's sort of like, hey, you know.
I'm still here too.
Right. Come on. You know, I may be little, but I can share that joke. Yeah. So they see that. It's more of the infant's attempt to get attention. And infants fake cry as well at about that age. So.
Oh, yeah. I think most parents will recognize that as well.
Right.
That flip side.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, laughter, one of the qualities of laughter is that it's a really difficult emotion to fake. So that's one of the reasons we see it as being so genuine in infants. It's pretty hard emotion even for adults to fake.
My baby is just over one. He finds snow pretty darn funny. I'm not really sure why, but babies certainly have their own idea of what's worth a giggle or a chortle or a belly laugh. And we're learning more about that today with Johnson State College professor Gina Miro, who's made great strides in what's known about our sense of how humor develops. Listeners, if you have a question about the way laughter grows in a child, if you want to tell us about your baby and what your baby finds or found hilarious, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or share your stories on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Mark who says, my youngest daughter, as an infant about 6 months old, was one of the participants in Dr. Miro's study.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Thanks.
Yeah, Mark says, I thought the premise of her work was fascinating, and as my wife and I are both scientists or have science backgrounds, we were interested to be a part of this work. Congrats to her and her research team. Keep up the good work.
Oh, how nice. Yeah, you know, Vermont families have been so responsive, just incredible. We go to them, so I send students to their homes, and they open their doors and their lives and let us bring cameras in, and so thank you so much to all of them for continuing to really help us find out what's going on in those little minds.
How long do you follow the babies for?
It depends on the study. These are longitudinal studies, so we typically follow them for as long as the first study went from 3 to 12 months. Most of the time we return for 3 visits over either 3 months or 6 months.
And what do? Just scroll through the town reports and see who had a baby recently to find the parents?
Kind of. Actually, what we do is we work with the Vermont Department of Health in their Office of Vital Records. So birth announcements are public record, and we can sort of target moms of infants who are within reach of us. So clearly we can't, unfortunately, get down to areas like southern Vermont, but we can reach Chittenden County, Addison County, Lamoille County, Washington County.
So you're sure that those babies don't find things that are funny that the Rutland County babies don't?
I'm not sure. But yeah, I'm pretty confident. Yeah.
We got a note from Cammie who says, my sweet 16-month-old thinks it's hilarious when her big sister plays boo with her. Nothing better than a baby's laughter.
Yeah, this is a great example, actually. So one thing about humor is that humor in general, not just for infants, but for adults too, tends to involve something surprising. And usually that surprise comes in the form of incongruity, meaning it's a mismatch between in the studies we do, we mismatch objects and their use. So, for example, putting a cup on your head or putting a ball on your nose, something like that. Similarly, it might be like a really big, burly man who speaks in a really high voice. That would be incongruous. But something surprising or incongruous isn't necessarily funny. So her big sister playing boo, you know, sneaking out and saying boo, gets this nice laughter response. But it might not necessarily, depending on the context. So clearly she's putting it in a kind of playful frame and the baby knows this. And yeah.
But does it depend on the baby too? I mean, some babies might find that funny and some alarming, or do all babies sort of have a shared sense of humor?
I think that there's great variability. So just like with adults, some babies have a lower threshold to smile. They smile much more easily. They find almost anything funny. Some babies, you have to work up a sweat a little bit more to get them to laugh. So it really may depend on the context of how this little joke happens. And the fact that this baby now really has this nice familiar relationship and a safe relationship with her sibling, then that really sets a nice stage for this to be a happy interaction instead of a scary one.
We have other comments from other parents who've been writing in. Ashley in New York says her 10-month-old is obsessed with rubbing noses with other people.
Oh.
He finds that hilarious. Amy in Bristol says of her 2-year-old, Joey thinks it's hilarious to get up and run away when getting his diaper changed. Then I'm chasing a naked baby around the house trying to put clothes on him. Oh boy. They are cute though, and they know it. So for a 2-year-old like that, he probably knows that while his mother doesn't totally find this funny, she also probably laughs at it. Are they sort of keying off that too?
Yeah. You know, what he's doing is something that's even more specific and something that I have not studied a lot. But again, my colleague Vasu Reddy in the UK has done a lot of work in this area, and that's teasing. So Vasu has observed teasing in infants as young as 9 months of age. And this is really fascinating because teasing suggests that the infant has some understanding that another person can be deceived or can be tricked. So the classic example really is when an infant offers an object and then whips it back when you go to take it, and they have this cheeky little smile on their face that, you know, they knew that this, that they could, they just tricked you, they got your number. But the fascinating thing to psychologists is that we didn't really think that children had that ability to understand someone else's mind until they were about 4 years old. So we're not suggesting that infants have the sophistication of a 4-year-old, but they've got some element in place of understanding that someone else's thoughts can be controlled. I don't like that word. It sounds negative, but they can be played with and teased a little bit. So,
and that's really key, isn't it? I mean, it's fun to know what babies are laughing at and why, but this really gets into human development and what we know about how babies have a sense of themselves as separate from other people, or a sense that other people have the ability to have their own mind and find things funny. I mean, that just wasn't, as you said, wasn't known. People thought that kids didn't have that till age 4.
Right. There's a name for that. It's called a theory of mind. And most of the research really suggests this comes on at about age 4, 4.5, somewhere in there. And you start to see a shift in children's behavior around that time. So they become more persuasive. They use deception more. They can use surprise more effectively. They can joke more effectively. But many of the studies that look at theory of mind are constructed in a way that wouldn't really reveal this in younger children. So when you look at naturalistic studies that happen in the home and just look at everyday deception, then parents do report 2-year-olds using deception, for example, or incredible persuasion. In our attempt to really control the variables, which I think is a very good objective in science, but what science has tended to underdo is really underestimate children as a result of the methodologies that we use.
We're talking today about the science of humor and how early it develops. Babies can laugh when they're just a couple of months old, and at the age of 1, they're already experimenting with making other people laugh. Gina Miro, a professor of psychology at Johnson State College, is one of the foremost researchers into infant humor, and she's with us today explaining how this skill develops. We're also hearing from many of you about your babies and about questions that you have about how she does her research, how we know these things about infant humor. You can ask your question by going to the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. We're going to hear from Kathy and Michael, who are on the line with us coming up. Again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Gina Miro, Johnson State College professor of psychology. Her research has been instrumental in our understanding of infant development, specifically how babies develop a sense of humor and what it says about their understanding of themselves and the world around them. We've been learning a little bit about the different stages that babies go through, what they find funny and when, and we're going to take a little bit of a deeper look now at what that all means and what else is left to study. And listeners, if you want to tell us something you've found puzzling about what your own baby finds or found funny, you can give us a call. We have a lot of parents telling us online about the things their baby thought was hysterical. So you can call again 1-800-639-2211 or go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Caleb in Boulder, Colorado says, "It really is wild how my son will look at something that is, to us, totally banal and then laugh his butt off, pointing like, seriously, are you seeing this?" And we, his parents, are like, "That's a lamp." And let's go to Kathy calling in from East Barrie. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment on my children that I had. And what I noticed was that the happier I was and the more that I smiled at them, the happier they were. Because when I had my daughter, I was so happy to have a daughter that I couldn't stop smiling. And so she turned out to be the happiest baby you ever saw. And so 5 years later, when I had a little boy, same thing, because he was just so adorable. I couldn't help but smile every time I looked at them. Mm-hmm. And that made it so that they were always so happy. And people would ask me all the time, how are they so happy? And I really think it was just, you know, I think they felt very comfortable to have somebody always happy in their face.
Oh, Kathy, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate that. Dr. Mira, what about that idea, though, that a parent or a caregiver can really influence the sort of demeanor of a child? And what happens if a child has parents who are very dour or, you know, not or depressed or are going through something difficult, that there's not a lot of laughter and smiling in the home?
Yeah, I'm really glad you called in with this, Kathy. First of all, it's just a great image, the thought of you and your children smiling and laughing and having such a cozy time together. And I think that one of the things that your example points out is that laughter is contagious. It's very difficult not to laugh when others are laughing. And some of us have been in that situation. Probably most of your listeners, Jane, have been in that situation where maybe you're in a situation where you're not supposed to laugh and someone starts laughing and it's very difficult to rein it in. So laughter is contagious, and we think that nature sort of arranged it that way. This is a way that we can connect not only with babies, but with other people. Laughter crosses the language barrier, for example. And it is one of the earliest, powerful, salient kind of emotional reactions that we can get from infants. So it's a wonderful way to connect with them long before they can talk. As far as your question goes, Jane, there are huge individual variations in laughter. I think we already touched a little bit on this, that some babies laugh really readily at almost anything, and other babies are a little harder to get to break out in a smile. But you're right in that if a parent or a primary caregiver, you know, who's really responsible for engaging the baby and caring for the baby, is emotionally unavailable for whatever reason, they're depressed, they're completely stressed, they've got too many other things going on in their life, and they can deliver care to the infant, so they can make sure the infant is fed and clothed and kept warm, those kinds of things, but they're not really emotionally engaged, then we do worry about that baby. Hopefully, that baby has at least one other person. It only takes one who can fill that role. Ultimately, the parent's responsibility is more than just meeting the baby's physical needs. It's about making sure that the infant finds the world safe and satisfying and fun. And that is the draw. That's the social bait, if you want to think of it that way, to pull the baby into the social world. And from that, everything happens. Learning happens. Physical development happens. Language happens. So if that emotional piece is in place early on, then all of those other things come as a result.
So there is some concern that if you live in a household with not much of that sort of social interaction or emotional connectedness, you need to find some way for your baby to have that.
Yeah. And it can be a babysitter. It can be a grandparent, somebody who has a lot of contact with that baby. There are parents have a lot of things going on in their lives. And the transition to parenthood is not an easy transition, even under the best circumstances. So I think that, you know, if parents are worried about this, they're worried that they're not able to engage with their baby, and they can get some support for themselves and make sure that there's somebody around who is meeting that need for the baby until the parent can sort of get back on track. Then the baby really will not suffer.
We got a note from Danielle in Toronto who says, yesterday I was with a friend and her cutie who was laughing his head off over dumping his freshly cut fruit all over the dirty school floor. He giggled and giggled over that one. Mom did not. Right. And let's go to Nichol, who's calling in from Guilford. Hi, Nichol. Go ahead.
Hi. First, I just wanted to thank you for just a great show. I mean, I remember when my daughters were going through this phase, and it's just, I've been smiling the whole show. I had two quick questions, one of which was, most of what you've talked about so far has been infant and they're learning humor. I was wondering, does any of your research deal with, like, later? Like, I'm thinking particularly of what I think is a fascinating topic, how people learn to tell verbal jokes.
Mm.
And the other is, I hope this doesn't sound like too strange a question, but what do you consider counting as a laugh? I mean, the guest said something earlier that there's a lot of variation. Mm-hmm. And what we think of as a laugh is primarily something we hear, but for instance, I'm wondering, for instance, like non-hearing children, what does a laugh mean in that context?
Nichol, thanks for your questions. Let's give it to Dr. Miro.
That's both great questions. So the first question you had to do with verbal humor, which I don't study specifically. That would certainly involve older children or adults. What we do know is that children can start to use verbal humor as soon as they understand words as labels. So somewhere after the first year, I would say in the 12 to 15 month range, what you might see is, let's say, an infant who really has a good grasp of the word, the label mama. She might point to her father and say mama and smile. And of course, probably elicit some surprise and laughter from those around her. So she's playing with, this is like the first verbal joke, you know, the first verbal joke that the baby cracks is to mislabel objects. So it does appear that early. About every other year I go to this great conference. It's a psychology of humor conference. And most of the people there are linguists and cognitive psychologists and people who study artificial intelligence, and they're really interested in this concept of verbal humor. Verbal humor also involves incongruity and absurdity. That's my understanding anyway, being a little bit outside of that. But the work of Robert Provine at the University of Maryland is really compelling and suggests that even with verbal humor, what ultimately makes something funny is the social context. It's the presence of another person. And most laughter does not follow a joke. Most laughter just occurs spontaneously in social settings. So people will say something like, yeah, I got to get back to work, ha, 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 you know, or they'll say, I had a really hard time finding a parking spot, ha, 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 you know, or something like that. There's nothing funny about what they're saying. So again, this is sort of that idea that humor is a way to engage and be present and social with other people. It's a social glue. That's the way we think of it.
And then Nichol also asked about non-hearing children or ideas of what counts as a laugh in children who maybe have different developmental stages or are different from the majority of children.
Right, right. So another great question. I don't know. There's so little research on laughter in hearing babies. I don't know of any research on laughter in babies who do not hear. However, there is some really fascinating work on signing in deaf babies or even hearing babies who are learning to sign, and that is that they will babble using signs. So their language progression follows the same sequence as spoken language. It's really fascinating. So I guess where I'm going with that is I don't know. I guess that's what it comes down to. I think that, you know, what Nichol is getting at is that humor is universal, but we might see some iterations of it in infants and children who are on a different developmental trajectory. And probably those who live with them and know them best are in the best position to determine what is a laugh. So I would defer to them on that and their experience with their baby.
We have a lot of questions from people. One is from Stephanie in Hinesburg, who says, my 21-month-old has begun to use wordplay and finds it hilarious, for instance, while reading a story where a chick was eating a pea, she said chickpea, as in garbanzo bean, which she loves, and looked at me and laughed. Stephanie says, I'm wondering if this type of language humor is typical or if we have a future stand-up comic on our hands.
Or a genius.
Yeah. Chickpea is pretty good.
That's a fantastic example, actually, of her recognizing, you know, these two words in a very different context. And I think it's a good example that for her, chickpea has a specific meaning. It's something that you eat. But she's recognizing in that book that this is almost like a play on words. It just happens in the reverse order than we might expect. We might expect a baby to learn what chickpea is later on, what the food is later on, and find that funny. So it's just a great example of her awareness of those words and a completely different use. It's almost like a pun or something like that that she's picked up on.
Yeah, that seems very impressive.
Yeah, I think so too.
Rachel in Jamaica says, my son has always laughed in his sleep as a wee baby and still now as a five-year-old. Giggles and more uproarious laughter. It's great. And I wonder how common that is.
You know, Rachel, my daughter did this as well, and she still does. She's in college now, and she's told me that when she's been on sleepovers and things, that her friends will say it's one of the things they love about having her sleepover is if they get to hear her laugh. And she's got a great laugh anyway. So I don't know how common it is. You know, and I had the same experience. I had never heard of this. And my son and I used to occasionally stand outside of her bedroom door and just eavesdrop on her laughing in her sleep because it was so funny. So, you know, I think it may be indicative of temperament, if anything else. She was a super sunny kid, and I'm wondering if Rachel's child is like that as well.
My son also, before he laughed with his eyes open, would laugh in his sleep, just little giggles and smiles. Kath in Ripton says, I didn't hear it mentioned that sometimes babies laugh in response to fear and or overstimulation. It's a definite social response, but not humor or delight as we usually define it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that and adults will do this too. We have nervous laughter, for example, that doesn't mean anything is funny. So laughter is not always indicative of amusement. And again, we have to use the context to figure that out. So, you know, somebody might be laughing in the dental chair, but chances are it's not because they're having a great time. So it's a great observation, Kath, on your part, that humor is very much context dependent.
We're talking with Dr. Gina Miro. She's a professor of psychology at Johnson State College, and her focus is on infant humor. And we're learning more about what babies find funny and what that means about human development. Susan's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Wonderful program. My children are grown now. They're in their 20s, but this is so fascinating. And it was intriguing to hear you say earlier in the conversation about very young infants teasing. And it made me think back to a couple of incidents when both of my children did that when they were about 6 to 9 months. My daughter was just spoon feeding, so she was very young, maybe 6 months or so. And at some point, she started to bite down on the spoon and just grin at me as if waiting for me to tug on it and setting up that response. And then my son, similarly, when he was just crawling, crawled behind floor-length drapes and waited to be found. And when his grandmother pulled back the drapes and found him, he had created his own little game of hide and seek and thought that was very funny. So I just think that that's interesting to hear it framed as this very early development of teasing and seeing that they could bring out that humorous response on someone else.
Yeah, Susan, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. And let's hear from Amy in Barnet. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hi. I always remember my niece's son, between, I would say, the age of 4 and 5 months old, was at a family camp on Lake Champlain, and he was napping under a tree, and the leaves were rustling in the sunshine, and no one was paying much attention to him. There were adults around, but no one was interacting with him. And he woke up from his nap, and he just started laughing. And he laughed and laughed, and I felt like he was laughing just out of joy, sort of. I don't know if that's true or not, but there was no kind of event that made him laugh, except for what he saw.
Mm. Amy, yeah, no social stimulus, Dr. Miro, in that sense, that was, you know, a response to another person.
Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing that he might have been laughing at, she mentioned the trees, the leaves rustling, and he may have been observing that for the first time and, you know, just not making that, not having made that connection before. So it's not always a social context, but if you had to put money down on it, then you'd be safer going with the social context. I wanted to respond to Susan's call about teasing and the example, especially of her daughter biting down on the spoon. That's a fantastic example. So teasing is this very special case of what we call provocative noncompliance. You know, teasing is an attempt to evoke an emotional reaction in somebody else. And it can even be a little bit riskier than just clowning around. And we actually have great examples of teasing in some other species as well. So chimpanzees engage in teasing. Usually the ones who are lower ranking status will tease the higher ranking status to try to provoke. So we're not the only ones who do it. But I love the example of her biting on the spoon.
Dr. Miro, you mentioned earlier that one of the things you've discovered, you and other researchers, is how early babies have a sense of themselves as separate from other people or of other people having minds of their own so they can elicit this laughter in other people and make a joke. What more do you hope to find, or what areas of research do we still need to do on infant humor?
Well, I think for us, you know, for me, I'm really interested to know whether or not infants, just like their innate sense of physics, or at least this very early sense of physics that they have, whether or not, because we are a social species, whether we are born with some, or at least, you know, have this very early bias toward, let's say, understanding how people interact or what's a typical kind of human interaction, and whether or not what we're seeing in these little infants in our lab is a violation of something that they already expect as early as 4 or 5 months of age. It's just fascinating to me that might be there. I don't know. It's a guess.
There's a lot more to research, clearly, and a lot more listener questions that we had. We'll see if we can get Dr. Miro to respond off air to a question about babies who don't smile and laugh mm-hmm. at an early age. What does that mean for their development? Do we know if that's likely to result in a baby that has developmental issues later on? We'll see if we can get her to respond to that, and we'll include it in a mailbag segment tomorrow or later. Dr. Gina Miro is a professor of psychology at Johnson State College. We have a link to her research at vpr.net. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you. Fantastic.
And coming up, we are going to talk about town meeting day. Addison County residents bucked the trend, sending many school budgets down to defeat. We'll try to get a handle on why they were doing that next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday was town meeting day in Vermont. One of the trends that we've seen as the results have come in from around the state is that far fewer school budgets were voted down this year than last year. Last year, 37 school budgets failed. So far this year, 198 school budgets have been passed and 20 have been rejected. There are still 20 to be voted on. But in Addison County this year, school budgets faced a rough go where 5 were rejected by voters, including 2 high school budgets that are voted on by several towns together. Joining us now to help understand why is Addison County Independent reporter Zach Despart. Zach, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So which towns voted down their elementary school budgets?
Sure. Well, there were 3 elementary school budgets that failed. And they were in Moncton, Ferrisburg, and Bristol.
Okay, and then 2 Union High School budgets in Addison County, as I said, were also voted down. Mount Abraham and Bristol, which incorporates the towns of Bristol, Lincoln, Starksboro, Moncton, and New Haven. And Vergennes Union High School, which has kids from Vergennes, Addison, Ferrisburg, Panton, and Waltham. In all of these towns, Zach, how close were the votes?
They were pretty close. I mean, if you look at Mount Abe, that one went down about 1241 to 1088. And then in Vergennes, it was 831 to 718.
So much closer in Vergennes than the Mount Abe budget, which sounds like it was almost 2-1 voting down.
The Mount Abe was only about 200 votes. So it wasn't.
Oh, 200 votes. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yep. but it's also worth noting that both the Vergennes High School and the Ferrisburg Central School budget, they both failed last year, too. But this year, the budget failures were by slimmer margins, if you can glean any hope from that.
So let's talk about a couple of specific towns. And Bristol, what have you figured out about Bristol voters' motivations?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Bristol budget only called for a 2.75% spending increase, but that wasn't the biggest issue that voters had with that budget. That budget would have cut 6 staff positions, 1 teacher, and 5 aides from the school, and a lot of parents were upset about that and wished that, they had a larger role in the budget forming process, and also they were hoping the school board could find some way to keep those jobs in the budget.
It sounds like that might be a similar conversation to what was happening in Moncton. There's been some discussion about frustration over the cuts that were made, not the dollar figure amount.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a combination of both in Moncton. If you look at their budget, it would have been over 9% increase, which is pretty steep compared to both towns in Addison County and across the state. But certainly there is a concern about cutting staff members at the school, especially when the supervisor union is adding positions there.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that, Zach, because that is one of the things that you're hearing from a lot of towns is this frustration over a lack of local control over supervisory union budgets, which the towns don't get to vote on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important point. A small committee made up of board members from different towns, they decide the supervisory union budget, and that's not voted on directly by residents, which is becoming a bigger and bigger concern, and that's because in the Addison Northeast, where Bristol is, and across the state, the trend is that supervisor unions are consolidating more and more of their costs from individual schools to the district as a way to improve efficiency, which does make sense, but voters have less control over that because they can't vote on those budgets directly.
So is there a sense that some of the frustration that voters felt and perhaps some of the reasons they were voting no on their school budgets was actually because of the supervisory union budgets?
I think so. I mean, if you look at Mount Abe's budget, for example, the proposed figure was actually less than last year. So the argument there that the budget was simply too expensive does not hold as much weight. And I think in that case, you can look much more towards a frustration about the whole process and how people can participate in it and how they wish they had more of an opportunity to participate.
So what else were people telling you yesterday during town meeting day or as you've looked at this issue as towns were trying to figure out what to do with their school budgets?
Well, I think a lot of people were looking at the legislature to see what may come out of there in terms of a way to reform the way schools are both structured and financed. Representative David Sharp, who is the chairman of the House Education Committee, spoke at both the Bristol and Moncton meetings, and he noted that the education bill that just emerged from his committee would create unified school districts with one board and one budget that incorporates all of the costs for a district, and then voters would get to vote on that directly. And that perhaps could be a reform that people are looking for.
So that bill in the budget, and we had Dave Sharp on the program recently, that idea is that towns would actually have more control over their sort of district budget, which they're feeling a lack of control over now.
Exactly. I mean, people would have less boards and less board members across the district, but they would have more direct control over the entirety of the costs.
Are there other issues in Addison County that you think might lead to Addison County being a little bit more heavy on the no votes than other parts of the state?
Well, I know speaking specifically to the Addison Northeast District, there are a lot of issues going on there that are on voters' minds. One, there is a teacher contract negotiation going on right now because their contract expires in June. There was some rancor in the 2011 teacher negotiations, so people are a little bit tense about that. There is also some dissatisfaction with the leadership of the Addison Northeast. Some residents circulated a petition in the last couple weeks that calls for the firing of Addison Northeast Superintendent David Adams. A couple hundred people have signed that and expressed some concern about his ability to lead the district. So that's definitely a concern as well.
Is it all school factors or are there other social factors you think in Addison County that might be leading to this? I mean, just sort of spitballing, I saw some talk on Facebook last night from voters that they might have sort of a less faith in this whole process. A lot of people complaining about pipeline issues, for example, and then local government and local boards that are making decisions for them.
Yeah, I mean, speaking totally big picture here, I think in a lot of issues, I mean, you mentioned the pipeline, certainly solar issues as well. certainly school issues. People in Addison County, and I suspect throughout the state, really they want to have a voice and they want to be able to participate in the process, no matter what that process is. A lot of people in Addison County were upset with how many solar projects have been approved here by the Public Service Board, and municipalities presently don't have a great, a significant role in that siting process. For the last couple of years, there's certainly been concerns about, you know, how towns can control the pipeline and where that's sited. So I think it all comes back to that main point of local control of whatever it is, if we're talking schools, if we're talking municipalities, if we're talking large infrastructure or energy products or projects. That's what people care about.
So, Zach, just remind us quickly what happens next for the towns that voted down their school budgets.
Sure. Well, it's back to the drawing board for the school boards. They will have to draft new budgets. They'll have to warn them, and then they'll have to vote again with residents. And usually that's in May. That's when that happened last year for the budgets that had failed. The one thing I would note, it's kind of tricky, and I was talking with Addison Northwest Superintendent Joanne Kenning this morning. She said, look, you know, we think some people voted down the budgets because we thought it was too expensive. Other people voted no because they thought the budgets cut too much. So the school boards are a little bit of a bind where should they cut more from the budgets or should they add more services back in? You know, what should they do and what do voters really want?
Well,
so
we'll have to wait and see. Yeah, I guess we'll wait and see until later in the spring when those budgets come back to the voters. Zach Despard is a reporter for the Addison County Independent. He's been telling us some of the reasons behind a significant number of Addison County towns voting down their school budgets yesterday. Zach, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And that will wrap up today's show. Tomorrow on the program, we'll look at the growing popularity of herbal remedies. We'll talk about how the companies making them are regulated and where to turn to for good, solid advice. If you have questions about the medicinals available commercially or the uses of herbal remedies, or if you want to grow your own, send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net and then tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.